The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got John Cozy back today. John's a retired philosophy professor. He does an awful lot of writing now. He taught for many years. He's been writing for so many more. And usually John sends me one or more articles a few days ahead of each program. And every time he sends one, I jump right on it. Oh, they make marvelous discussion on this program. One he sent me a couple of days ago, he called "The Why of Not Doing the Right Thing." What an appropriate subject for an article, John. I mean, we can play with that title in lots of directions. But John, welcome. Number one, number two. I'll let you start off by discussing what you wrote about in this article.
Oh, hello, Stephen. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Doing fine.
My article was pretty simple. Many years now, I have noticed that the courts in this country continually promote decisions and policies that do not provide fairness to plaintiffs. And this first became evident to me 50 years ago, when I was appointed to a commission in the state of North Carolina to rewrite the criminal law. That commission was comprised of law school professors, prominent judges, and practicing attorneys, and me. How I got on there is a long story, but anyhow, that's what it was made up of. And it became evident to me rather quickly that the members of the legal profession on that committee were not about to make any substantive changes to the law. And the argument always was that we can't impose the burden of learning new laws and procedures on the legal profession. So, we did rewrite the law. We've cleaned up some bad sentences and introduced some modern diction. But if the law was unjust before we started, it was still unjust when we finished. And that stuck in my mind ever since then. And recently I read an article online about Judge Alito, who was troubled, he claimed, by the conflict between doing what is right for plaintiffs and protecting the institution of law in this country as we have known it, as it has grown up. And I went on then to give some examples of a number of cases, going back all the way, of course, to Marbury versus Madison, in which the Supreme Court issues clear and undisputable unjust decisions that are not just to their plaintiffs. And the conclusion was that injustice or unfairness has a long history and is deeply rooted in the American legal system.
John, it reminds me of a line that I've used a number of times when it comes to how America wants other nations, other leaders, to conform to what it wants. And my line is something like, America's the boss. What we say goes. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's legal or illegal or anything else, whether it's good for us and bad for you. We're the boss, and what we say goes. And if you disagree with that, then we'll send in the Marines, or at least they hint that, something like that. So yeah, the court, yeah. The same thing. I guess Marbury versus Madison was really the notorious decision where John Marshall decided that the Constitution doesn't matter. It's only what I say that matters. What I say goes, not what the Constitution. Isn't that the way America's been run ever since, John?
Yes, it has. And the reason that I wrote that piece now was because of the Occupy movement. Everybody's talking about how, you know, we don't know what the Occupy movement wants. Well, of course we know what it wants. It wants fairness. And I wanted to point out that it wants what America has not had, at least since 1803. I said that if a society can't trust its courts to do the right thing, why would anyone in that society expect any other institution to do the right thing?
Well, John, can I just make a comment about that? Boy, do I ever agree with that comment. I write so often. I have a number of topics I go back to all the time, and a big one for me is the issue of political prisoners in America. And once the Justice Department, once the prosecutors, usually at the federal level, but it can be at the state level too, once they get their claws into somebody they want to convict, innocence is of no consequence, and they just manipulate the whole process. You've got so many right of center or extremist right-wing judges on the court. A lot of the federal ones come from the Federalist Society, so many of them, an extremist right-wing organization. I mean, neocon to the core. And the system is just corrupted so that the powerful people get exactly what they want. If they decide they want to lock somebody up for life, well, that's okay. The court will go along with that, and they'll put away innocent people. People who never committed a crime are languishing behind bars. Some of them got the death sentence, but they didn't kill anybody. And even when they know someone is innocent, like Troy Anthony Davis, that was a Georgia case, not a federal case. But even when they know someone's innocent, and there wasn't the shadow of a doubt that he was innocent, his appeals ran out and they killed him. That's the way the country's run.
Well, yeah, you know, and it doesn't take much to translate that to foreign policy. So now we just kill foreigners that we don't like. You know, we don't even pretend to try them anymore or petition them. We're just gonna snuff them out.
Well, that's exactly right. The imperial wars that are waged against non-belligerent countries that never threatened America, don't threaten their neighbors, they're not a threat to anybody, and what they do internally in their own country really is the business of the people in those countries. It certainly is not the business of any outside power, and there's nothing in international law that says an outside power can intervene. And even the so-called notion of humanitarian intervention, John, I think the way it's discussed in legal terms, I don't know if it's specifically in international law, but the way it's discussed, it excludes the possibility of military intervention. It really, I mean, this, oh, a General Assembly, I think one or two resolutions on so-called responsibility to protect, that at least one General Assembly resolution discussed that. I think it was two. I wrote about it. I can't remember if it was one or two, but the principles that they enunciated were diplomacy, never military intervention, never belligerence, never force. These things need to be settled diplomatically, nonviolently, and that stipulation has been totally distorted. So that was one of the things used as a pretext to wage war on Libya, and it was a total fraud.
Well, yeah, I mean, but all wars are fraud. So, you know, that doesn't surprise me or even, you know, get me terribly upset. I mean, Libya was a small war. Yeah, it was a fraud, but Iraq was a big war, and it was a fraud, and Afghanistan is a bigger war, and it was a fraud, and so was Vietnam, and so was Korea, and, I mean, the World War II may very well have been a big fraud. So, you know, that doesn't... That's common. That's stuff that...
Oh, I agree.
We've been doing it. And I just I don't write about stuff like that merely because I don't think it teaches anybody anything. But the piece I wrote this week, I thought, was very instructive in that I simply, listed the cases, explained them, said what was going on, and said, look, this is unfair, yet it happens all the time, so why should we expect anything different from anyone, any other institution in America, whether it be the Congress, the financial community, the business community? I told someone the other day, I said, one thing you can be sure of, if you go into a store in America, you're going to be cheated. It's as simple as that. And somebody said, well, what do you mean you're going to be cheated? Oh, there's this old doctrine, caveat emptor, says buyer beware, let the buyer beware. Well, you don't tell the buyer to beware unless you suspect that the seller is going to cheat him. I mean, it's as simple as that. So, I mean, cheating in American business is as common as the sun coming up in the morning. And the maxim that the buyer has to beware takes for granted that if he doesn't beware, he's going to get cheated. That cheating is a common business American business practice, and it's very difficult for the buyer to beware these days. I mean, you can't look at things anymore and see which ones are good and which ones aren't. That's all that's hidden underneath something or other. The whole economy is a criminal enterprise, but then again, the whole nation, the whole culture is a criminal enterprise. There's nothing you can do about that. Anyhow, the reason I wrote the piece was, we can take out foreigners that we don't like, and then you look at what happened at University of California at Davis yesterday or the day before, where this hurly burly policeman, about four times as big as any student on the campus, was spraying people sitting on the ground with pepper spray. And I say to myself, what's he afraid of? This hurly burly guy, with more equipment on him than our infantry had in June of 1944, 45, when they landed on Omaha Beach. This guy is armed to the teeth.
It's a classic example of a bully, John. They wear a uniform.
Yeah. And I say to myself, what in the world are the cities that equip police with all of this stuff thinking?
Well,
when I can't think of a riot in America since one in Los Angeles or somewhere decades ago. A major riot in America hasn't taken place for decades. Why does every police force, even little towns, have riot gear for their police?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Explain that to me. Why would police go out to a peaceful demonstration dressed in riot gear?
Yeah, when there's violence, it's police instigated.
They're going out there to create a riot.
That's right. And then they blame it on the nonviolent protesters, accuse them of all kinds of things that never happened. I mean, these protests have been scrupulously nonviolent. I mean, people are literally putting up with an awful lot of abuse and going out of their way not to strike back. But the cops have been very, very brutal.
The American public puts up with is so stupid that I have a hard time, believing that this is a real world and I'm not, laying in a bed somewhere delirious. and you know, I don't know about it. But, you know, there was this video posted about this young girl in California being beaten by her father, who was a judge. You know, and everybody said, you know, yeah, this is child abuse. This is child abuse. This is child abuse. It sure was. No question about it. Okay? But then we had a video posted of a policeman punching a non-violent, non-opposing person in the face and beating him to a pulp, his face to a pulp. And the police say, oh, well, you don't know the whole story. Well, you didn't need the whole story to know that judge beating his daughter was of excessive violence. Why do you have to have the whole story here?
Well, John, the whole story is always the one-sided story that the cops or the authorities present. And whatever the other side is, it just gets discounted, shoved aside, doesn't matter. It's what the official story is from the authorities that count.
But my point is, why are the American people so dumb as not to understand that they don't see? You know, you don't need a 3-month investigation to know what happened at University of California yesterday or the day before. It doesn't take 3 months to look at that and say, hey, these cops are out of hand. But, you know, the chancellor there, who's under fire, comes up with a committee to investigate and report back in 3 months.
3 months.
I mean, what the hell are they going to do for 3 months?
They're going to do nothing, John. They're going to sit around and play
you know,
poker.
That's the point. You know, so we have this society that listens to this stuff and prominent members of the society who are supposed to know something, who don't call this stuff into question. I just get, you know, I'm a pet owner. I've always loved dogs and had dogs, always had dogs. There was a story within the last week, maybe 2 weeks, of pet food containing salmonella. And the salmonella in the pet food wasn't dangerous to human beings from the dogs, but that, you know, you could get it from the food if you handle the food and put the food in places where you're handling human food and that kind of stuff. And the story was that everybody, you know, who has pets and uses and buys pet food needs to engage in all sorts of prophylactic activities. So you don't put the food on your sink counter or your kitchen counter. You know, don't put your bowls on the counter or whatever. And I said to myself, what kind of baloney is this? Damn, if there's salmonella in the dog food, take it out. Don't tell people all the things they have to do to avoid it. But no, we don't take we don't do that kind of thing. But you can't ask the dog food manufacturers to take the salmonella out of their dog food, for heaven's sakes. Well, that would cost them money. What a fraud of a society this is.
Well, it really is, John. It frustrates me the same way it frustrates you. You can look at so many different issues, domestic, global. My goodness, I mean, lawlessness, corruption, really causing so much harm to so many people. A very tiny elite in the country are the only ones who seem to benefit. And is there any wonder why the people protesting call themselves the 99%? It's a nice metaphor. It really, it's a little bit more than 1% of people in the country profit from the system. You could say the top 10% profit from the system, but the 99% is a resonating metaphor, and certainly the ones that profit the most, the super rich, they're really a lot less than the top 1%, maybe 0.1%. They're the super rich in the country, and I mean, they're literally the ones that can actually, in fact, get away with murder. They can get away with anything, and so many examples, one after another. Once in a while, they throw one of their own to the wolves, but there's usually a story behind that. The story behind Bernie Madoff was that he fessed up to his family. His house of cards finally collapsed. He ran a Ponzi scheme. Everybody in power on Wall Street knew it. Nobody did anything about it. The regulators knew it. They didn't do anything. Just winked and nodded, let him get away with it for many years. And then during the 2008 collapse, his Ponzi scheme collapsed. He fessed up to his family, and his son turned him in.
Yeah, his son turned him in, and then one of them committed suicide. I mean,
if the son kept his mouth shut, or if he was part of a scam, Bernie might still be out there stealing today.
But stupidity is a thing that I have fought against ever since I, you know, left the army and became a student. And I fought against stupidity in my professors, and I'm still fighting against it today. But I said to someone the other day, you know, there's always at least two ways to solve the problem. I said, what if Abraham Lincoln, when he decided to rid the country of slavery and decided to emancipate the slaves, had instead thought to himself, hey, look, there's another way to eliminate slavery in this country. All you have to do is kill all the slaves, you know. And that is really the kind of position that American elite takes today, especially the Republican Party and the right wing. You know, you want to eliminate poverty in this country? Fine, we'll help you. We'll kill all the poor. You know, you want to eliminate Medicare in this country? Fine, we'll kill all the aged sick. You know, that's the solution. And Americans sit by day after day, month after month, year after year. They listen to this stuff, and nobody does anything.
John, they can do it. Not blatantly by shooting them down or something as obvious as that, but there are a lot of ways to get rid of people.
Well, sure.
You can slow poison them. I mean, you can feed them harmful drugs, harmful food. You can pollute their water. They can come up with the deadly diseases. Have very short lives.
There's so many ways. But you know the thing is, yeah, I was, you know, the big Penn State sex scandal, sex abuse scandal. You know, we had a coach, and you know, it hasn't yet been proven. He may be innocent, but pedophilia, you know, is common in not only in America, all over the world. Hell, in some countries, it's perfectly acceptable. And they say, well, this is child abuse, and I say, okay, yeah, kids shouldn't be subjected to that kind of thing. But we have kids in this country who are going to bed hungry every night. Nobody says that's child abuse.
Boy, how
and
true.
It is.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, why aren't we calling people, I mean, why aren't we ridiculing people like we're subjecting the Penn State coaches to ridicule over this scandal? Because our country is abusing children every day. Go into the slums in any big city in America. You want to see child abuse? Just look at where they have to live. We have such a trivial damn country. I don't understand it. You know, and we have college presidents. You know, a year or two ago, I was living in Texas. I'm not living in that state anymore. Well, I was living in Texas, and the right-wing-dominated Board of Education was mandating that all sorts of idiotic, false things be taught in the public schools. And I said, how come there's not a single university chancellor of all of the chancellors in this state coming out and saying, hey, guys, that's wrong? Not one did. Not the University of Texas, not Texas A&M, not any school in Texas has a chancellor that had the courage to stand up to the State Board of Education, which was appointed by Mr. Perry, you know, and say, hey, guys, you can't do that. The kids will come to college and won't know a damn thing that we have to then teach them. No, they didn't even say anything as neutral as that. They were hiding under their damn desks. That's the kind of people we promote in this country to positions of authority. I mean, they ought to be made to wear clothes with a yellow stripe down the back. I'm wound up today, aren't I?
Oh, John, I feel the same way. My frustration level, I don't know how I can stay calm. The stuff that I write about, John, so many different topics, and they're all on things that relate to wrongs. So many of them committed by our country, John. And I scratch my head sometimes and I say, how can I stay calm? Knowing what I dig out and write about and explain, and the stuff is so outrageous, how can I stay calm in the midst of this? And I can remember, it's been a while, but I can remember being asked once or twice, why don't you write about something good? And I know my answer was, when I find it, I'll write about it.
Yeah.
And when I'm, well, of course, I mean, my meaning was clear. I just don't know anything good to write about. Everything going on in terms of the people with power and how they use it, domestically or globally, I don't know of anything good to say about any of it. And America leads the pack in committing wrongs, but it sure has an awful lot of willing partners. The big Western NATO countries, the key NATO allies, too many of the others, Israel, and the various other countries that ally, Middle East countries that partner with America on committing some of the worst crimes. And, I mean, this stuff could just keep me busy endlessly, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, American foreign policy is run by bribery. I mean, the NATO countries do what America wants because we pay their military budgets. You know, if the British and the French had to pay for their own military budgets, they wouldn't be getting in any wars. But they don't. We pay them, and we're doing the same thing, you know, to the Arab nations that are supposedly our buddies. I mean, we're still giving money to the Egyptian military, and of course the Egyptians are rioting in the streets today about you know, what's happened there. And you know, that's it. We pay off people. How did we get the Baathists in Iraq to quit trying to kill our troops? Why? We created little outfits for them and started paying them to be on our side. I mean, we never defeated them. I mean, we and the neat thing is that we don't have any money anymore. We're using, you know, money from China to pay them. Well, that's okay. One of these days the Chinese will say no more, and then we won't be able to pay anybody. And those people that we're paying now, bribing now, will flee like chickens from a fox. I mean, you can't establish a secure foreign policy by bribery. Sooner or later, you know, the bribe, somebody else will come by with a bigger bribe.
And you can't run a nation forever. A line that I use is ravaging the world one country at a time, John. I mean, that's a marvelous way to make enemies.
Yeah.
And it's a marvelous way to spin yourself into bankruptcy. And, I mean, America's influence certainly isn't what it was at its apex at the end of World War II. And I just wonder how long it'll take before the influence wanes entirely. The only thing America is number one in is military power, but it's losing its economic supremacy. Let's take a break, John. Take a short break, and then we'll come back and we'll continue this. Welcome back on with John Cozy. John, you mentioned the Egypt situation on Friday. I was interviewed on Russia Today about about Egypt. Just a quick word. It inspired me to want to write an article about it. I'll get it out tomorrow. And I think everybody remembers that back in February, Hosni Mubarak was ousted. What they don't know is that America was behind the ousting. I mean, that was part of the story. That was a big part. I mean, the whole thing was engineered from the outside, and the Egyptian military was complicit in going along with this. Well, the title of my I wrote a good deal about Egypt at that time. Hadn't written much in a good while, and the article I'll put up tomorrow is called Egyptian Military Power Grab. Well, the deal was Mubarak's gone. We're supposed to have elections. We're supposed to turn the country over to a civilian authority, parliament, prime minister, president, all elected. Well, that's not the way it's working, John. The military junta is running the country worse, more oppressively than Mubarak ever did it. And I discussed this a little bit in about 4 or 5 minutes that I had on air. Russia Today is a news program, so they bring on several guests, and they simply can't give anybody too much time. Otherwise, instead of being a news program, it would be like this. But people who tune in, and I do every day, I mean, I want to get the news. So it's great to get some comments, but I want to know what's going on at the same time, because you sure don't get it on U.S. television, even though some cable channels pick up Russia Today. My building does. But you can get it online. Anybody can go online and watch it, or as I listen more than watch, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's marvelous. It's just marvelous.
Yeah, they invited me to come on about a month ago, and I had to decline because I don't have Skype.
Oh,
and
that
was the only way I could reach him.
That's right. They do it on Skype. If you're in a city where they have a studio, they have a New York studio, they have a Washington studio, they may have a Los Angeles studio. They do not have a studio in Chicago. That baffles me. Maybe they will one day. But really, for me, John, it's a lot more convenient doing it by Skype. Doing it live from a studio means I have to schlep down to the studio wherever it may be located.
Yeah, I know.
And that takes a lot of time. I'll do it. And I go on Press TV, going to a downtown studio, not Press TVs, but to a downtown studio to pick up a satellite feed. Sometimes they interview me over the telephone, but sometimes they want me in the studio. And if they want me, I go. But it's 30 minutes downtown, 30 minutes back, a 30-minute program divided three ways with two other guests. So nobody gets all that much time, but the program they usually have me on is marvelous, just marvelous, called News Analysis, and they discuss important topics. They bring good people on. Some of them have been on this program, and you really get some very accurate commentary on major issues going on, and they'll cover the waterfront. And, I mean, there's nothing like it on U.S. television, so the fact that I get a chance to go on something like that, I want to do it.
I would have gone too, except that I'm not in a financial position to afford multiple communications media, and so I have one telephone and one computer.
Oh, that's all I have, John. That's all. No fancy equipment I work with. I've got a decent computer, and I do have Skype, and my computer desktop up top has got a built-in camera, and I'm very small, John, so I have to elevate myself, so my head isn't tilted way upwards looking at that camera, and still I look a little bit at an angle, so I forget. You know, when you're talking to somebody, you want to look straight ahead. You don't want to look to the left or the right or down or up. You just want to look straight ahead. But I really have to look up a little bit, because if I look straight ahead, I'm not looking directly in the camera. When I go to the studio downtown, it's very simple. I could look straight ahead. I'm looking smack dab into the camera. They have an arrow on it that basically tells me where to look, and I just have to look straight ahead to do it. But,
yeah, well, I don't have Skype, and I don't have a camera. So.
Well, Skype is free, John. Skype is free. I needed someone to download it for me. I'm not too good at that stuff. And when they have an upgrade, and I try to do it, somehow I mess it up. So I get by with what I have that seems to work fine. And the next time I get a computer, I'll get the latest version. But it's free, and you can make free Skype phone calls to anybody who also has Skype. They may have changed this system, but when I first began, you could call anybody in the world, no cost, if you were calling Skype to Skype. And if you didn't, it was still reasonably priced. I don't really use it for that. I prefer using the telephone, and I don't make overseas calls. Very rarely would I make an overseas call. So I prefer the telephone, and you can find a reasonably priced telephone service, so the AT&Ts and Sprints of the world don't rob you, and I did. And it's called Touchtone. If anybody wants to check them out, you can check them out online. Touchtone, I believe it costs 3 cents a minute to call anywhere in the U.S. Your own state is a little bit different. But if you call out of state, I think it's 3 cents. And a lot of parts of the world, you can call pretty cheap. If you want to call the Central Republic of Africa or someplace, it probably gets pretty expensive.
I'm fine with what I got.
Oh, I'm fine with what I have. I just want the basics. And of course, a computer is so essential, John. We simply couldn't do what we do without one.
Oh, I don't know. I used to, what do we do without? I remember pounding things out of a typewriter.
Well, it was your profession. I mean, you were a professional. I was just a small business guy, and when I began, I commented to people that I hadn't written anything serious since grad school, and I finished doing that at the end of 1959. So, you know, over 50 years later. My goodness, what is this writing business all about? And I still like to comment, John, that back in school, when instead of computers, you had abacuses.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Instead of calculators, you had abacuses.
Yeah.
And instead of computers, you had Rolodex cards.
Hey, look, I still have a slide rule.
Oh, I used the slide rule a little bit at one time.
Anyhow, let's get back to something important.
Oh, absolutely, John. Get back to your article and the corruption of the system. Let me let you continue on that.
Yeah, you know, my point was simply that, you know, when the institution in a society that people would count on or expect to count on for fair play and justice doesn't provide it, then there's nothing in the society that's going to provide it. And when people talk about, you know, all the corruption in government, all of that corruption is made possible by the court. All of it. You try to rid the corruption in the American government, try to get that corruption out of the American government, and the court will shoot it down every time. You know, and nobody says, I must be the only person in the world saying that. I don't hear anybody saying it. Nobody picks it up on the news, nothing. I mean, Rattigan on MSNBC is trying to come up with a constitutional amendment to overthrow the decision in Citizens United that made corporations persons. And I point out that, you know, okay, you can do that, and it might help a little bit, but it won't solve the problem because, you know, that's just one instance of injustice in the court system. What you need is something that the Founding Fathers goofed up on. They did not put a check on the Supreme Court. And I would suggest something like, that we establish a way for people upon petition, and I mean people, not just registered voters, but people upon petition to call for a referendum to vote up in any Supreme Court decision that they feel is wrong up and down. Put the court's decisions back in the hands of the people. Expand the democracy in this country instead of limit it. The courts would get wise pretty quick if their decisions were being knocked down by referendum over and over and over again. That's the only way I can think of to make that happen. And I put that in that article hoping that somebody would pick up on it, but I don't think anybody is going to. I've gotten some interesting comments on the article, but nobody has picked up on that point. And I keep on saying myself, you know, that's really the meat of the piece. Don't you follow the logic? But no, it doesn't get to anybody. So I don't expect anything to happen, but that's what I would suggest. I mean, I have all sorts of interesting suggestions. Congressional pay. You want to make Congress pay attention to what's happening to their constituents? Make their pay a function of their constituents' per capita income. All right. 1.5 times your constituents' per capita income, Senator. That's all you can earn. I wonder how many of the people in Congress would run.
I don't think we'd get too many takers, John. Along with that, that they could keep all they can steal. In that case, they don't need a salary. They can simply grab what they want. The way the system works now.
Yeah, you'd have to write the amendment in such a way that they couldn't earn any other outside income while they were also in Congress. But you could do that. You know, the Constitution never meant for congressmen to be able to set their own pay in the first place. You know, they're only getting around that because they've all become professionals and they run for office over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. You know, they violate the spirit of the Constitution every time they raise their pay. So you can fix that. I mean, make their pay, you know, tie their pay to their constituents' per capita income. That means that these guys coming from southern states where their constituents are per capita income of their constituents is impoverishment, you know, make them work that same for the same pay in Congress. That wouldn't last long.
Well, John, I go along with that. I must say that they not only do they raise their pay, they generally do it in a stealth way, maybe in the middle of the night when it gets little or no attention.
Yeah, because they don't want anybody to know they're doing it. And the newsmen who are covering in Congress are all asleep.
Well, and they probably ignore it anyway. Or if they mention it, it's in a throwaway line that few people notice. But at the same time, John, while they're doing that, they vote for cuts in benefits to ordinary people, whether it's Medicare. I fully expect Social Security cuts coming up. They freeze federal wages while they're raising their own. I mean, talk about gross hypocrisy. I mean,
well, who recently revealed the fact they're all benefiting from insider training?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know why when these congressmen are interviewed on TV, aren't asked bluntly, why are you willing to engage in a corrupt enterprise? Why are you a corrupt person? I mean, everybody admits that they're corrupt except them.
Well, John, I have an article that I haven't gotten out yet. I wrote about I believe Palestinian. Let me just call him Arabic. I believe a Palestinian, but I'll call him an Arabic reporter. I think a gentleman of some esteem, a member of the National Press Club in Washington. He went to the press club earlier in November. A Saudi prince was invited to the press club to address the audience of the Washington Fifth Estate establishment. Plus, I don't know who shows up to these events, but journalists, other maybe local dignitaries, whatever, they come. Well, they invited this criminal of a criminal state, and this journalist, a man by the name of Husseini, he had the courage. He apparently got his turn to ask a question. How they do it at the press club, I don't know. But in any event, he got a chance to ask a question, and he put a very long question to the Saudi prince, where he basically said, How do you justify your legitimacy? And then he enumerated a number of things that is so wrong with the way Saudi Arabia is run. I mean, this repressive, tyrannical state, and he rattled off a number of things, and this prince was willing to engage him in a discussion. I mean, not give him a legitimate answer, but he kept his cool, and I think they had a little go around together. But the result for this man Husseini was the executive director of the National Press Club suspended him. And the reason was, and I've got it in my article, it was basically calling what he said outrageous, disgraceful language, something to that effect. I mean, the guy asked a legitimate question that the cowards in the journalist corps refused to ask any politician, let alone somebody from a foreign country, and this journalist had the courage to do it, and it was wonderful. I quoted him verbatim in my article, and his reward, suspended from the press club, and of course, when a journalist on one of the major networks even inadvertently says something that isn't what the bosses of the network want put over their airwaves, they fire them on the spot.
Yeah, I mean, we all know that that's going on. I mean, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. I would have been fired a long time ago if I hadn't been retired.
Believe me, I can believe that. I'm well aware of past people who were fired from universities because they did the right thing. The name that comes to mind right away, John, was Michael Pareni. And you know who Michael Pareni was. He taught at Yale. I think he taught at a couple of other schools as well. But because he was so outspoken about the things that you need to be outspoken about, they sacked him. Some people get lucky and they hang on, but usually Norman Finkelstein in Chicago, he had the courage to take on Israel, and at the behest of the Israeli lobby, DePaul University sacked him. And this goes on repeatedly, time and again. A guest on my program, John. Let me mention one more name. A guest on my program, he hasn't been on in a while. I want to get him back on. He's dealing with some other personal issues that take a lot of his time. Professor Denny Rancourt, a world expert in his field, physics, and also environmental science, so twice over. And he was sacked from the University of Ottawa for standing up for the rights of Palestinians. To me, this is heroism. His reward,
sure
they fired him. They didn't fire him for that reason, of course. They manufactured reasons to fire him. They based it on his academic performance that was extraordinary. His students loved him. He changed the classroom technique to, in his mind, enhance learning, and his experience from the responses on exams from students showed that what he was doing was working, that maybe everybody should use the same things that he was doing. He didn't care so much about grades. He wanted kids to learn. That's what classroom teaching is all about, right, John?
Well, sure. You hear people still ask once in a while about Germany in the 1920s, and they say, can it happen here? And I always say, people, it happened here a long time ago. You know, I mean, nothing I write about is really new. I mean, you can see the stupidity. The only reason I write about it is because nobody else does.
John, it just repeats over and over again. The great journalist of a past era who died at age over 100 in the mid-1990s, George Seldes. I've got a bunch of his books on my shelf. In the 1930s, John, when Franklin Roosevelt was president, he wrote about the threat of fascism in America. In America! Not Nazi Germany. In America!
Yeah, I mean, there were people. I mean, you know, it's a funny thing. I was thinking to myself the other day, when I heard someone in the Occupy movement being interviewed said that he believed in capitalism, and of course the news made a big thing out of that. I mean, how wonderful! Here's one of these kids believing in capitalism, and I thought to myself, what a dumbass! You don't believe in an economic system. It's not a religion. You know, and yet you know, it's the kind of thing that gets by in front of American newsmen all the time. I mean, I read an economics blog every day, a pretty prominent one, and you never see them write, "We know this" or "We know that." You hear one guy saying, "I believe so and so," and another guy saying, "Well, I don't believe that. I believe so and so." This is pure baloney. And these guys are teaching most of the people who publish on this blog, you know, are university professors, and they're going in front of their classes teaching economics what they believe. They belong in a school of theology.
Oh, boy. Indeed, John. And I must say, just on the topic of capitalism, it's a double hypocrisy, because what people call capitalism in this country is not capitalism. It's not capitalism. There's no competition.
Well, there's no competition. There's no risk.
That's right. I mean, if you take a risk and lose, the taxpayers bail you out.
Yeah, somebody bails you out. I mean, you know.
I mean, I'm not certain that capitalism ever existed in America. It certainly doesn't now. I mean, you've got a corrupted oligarchic monopolistic system. It had nothing to do with capitalism. You go into a textbook and you read the way capitalism, how they define it. Well, that doesn't exist in America today. Well, for sure, nobody on television or in the mainstream press would dare explain it that way.
But that's the thing. And the point I was going to get at is that there was far more intellectual debate in America in the 1920s than there is today. This country intellectually has gotten dumber in 90 years. Much dumber. The intellects in America, American intellectuals don't, for the most part, even exist anymore.
Why is that, John? Why do you think that's so?
I don't know. Success in America is measured almost exclusively in terms of money. And even the people in our academic people, most of them don't make any money. I never did. I was working in a small state university that could hardly keep its sidewalks clean, no less pay people money. The lure of money. People are easily corrupted, especially people who have to scrunch for a living. And I think that's what happened. You know, publishers won't publish books unless they say what the establishment wants. You know, and if they do get published by some obscure publisher, the publisher doesn't have enough money to market them so that nobody buys them or very few people buy them. The whole thing is... Everything that's wrong with America, or even the world today, everything is a result of the economic policies that all our nations, or most of our nations, have adopted. I mean, you know, global warming would not have been a problem if we hadn't become industrialized worldwide. Yeah, you know, the rapid transmission of diseases from continent to continent would not be a problem if we hadn't engaged as we do in international trade. Invasion of foreign species into our country, which take over things like the mollusk in the Great Lakes, or some kind of fish in the Mississippi River, isn't this one that's taken over the river now, wouldn't be a problem. Or even kudzu in the south, that the people thought, oh boy, we could plant this next by highways and not have to mow the grass, and it's taken over their trees. You know, none of this would be the case if we didn't engage in international trade, and that's a human decision. It's not foisted on us by nature like a hurricane or a tornado or a storm or, you know, whatever. It's We cause our own problems by making these dumb decisions, not asking ourselves, what happens if, you know? I don't know. We wouldn't have a problem with oil. We wouldn't need oil from the Middle East or from Africa or anywhere else if we hadn't made the automobile the primary means of transportation in this country.
And John, the same thing holds.
All of these things are just decisions that we make that bring the world down upon us.
John, it's so true, and we do so many things that cause so much harm. The examples are endless, and it really is an example of a very sick society. And my feeling is it's gone beyond the point of no return. And I feel that really the only solution in my mind is to take it down and build it up from the ground up all over again. I believe we're just about out of time. I believe in direct democracy. You mentioned referenda. Oh, I absolutely believe in a system like that. I mean, the people have nothing to say about anything. It's the power brokers.
In a country like this, we ought to choose our representatives and senators the way the Athenians did, by lot. You know, have people draw straws.
And I'd like to see them stay for a short period of time.
Believe me, they wouldn't want to go back.
Well, citizen legislators that serve a short term and then leave and others take their place. Above all, John, I'd like to see a system where the people who hold the political positions actually represent everybody instead of that tiny, minute percent.
Yeah.
John, we are out of time.
There's the music. Can I say something?
Sure.
After the last show we did, I had some interesting messages from some of your listeners, and I want to thank them and invite them and others to write me again.
Oh, I think that's wonderful, John. I get some interesting comments, too. Oh, it's tremendous. Well, John, you certainly are one of my favorites, and I look forward to getting you back next month for another round and reading more of your articles. John, we will talk then.
Okie doke, Stephen.
Thank you, John. And of
course,
join.
Bye-bye.
Join us weekly, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.